What's up, everybody? This is the Toasty Podcast. My name is Sky.
And I'm Maddie B.
Today, I have the privilege of talking with the very own, ArenaNet's very own, Kai Harris. He's also my brother, so that's pretty dope. We're going to be talking about the insane rise of the video game industry, because these days, let's face it, any five-year-old across the street can beat you at any other game you want to try and play. And man, I like that. So let's get toasted. All right, listeners, the thing is that we're doing a Zoom call. With that, it means there could be dropouts, there could be cutouts, there could be any other kind of out you can think of. I will have to edit that out. I'm sorry. So you might miss some juicy deets. Welcome to the Toasty Podcast, Kai.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you made it on. Really, I am.
Yeah.
Really heartfelt there. So anyway, really the main thing is, what is the day in the life of a producer at a video game company?
So I work at ArenaNet. I'm a senior producer there, working on Guild Wars 2. Day in the life for me, a lot of meetings, a lot of following up with people, a lot of tracking, make sure that things get done. For those who may not know what a producer does exactly is, we're kind of the glue or kind of the nucleus that everything else swirls around. So we work with designers and artists and audio team members and localization and marketing and anyone else to make sure that people are talking to one another, to make sure that things aren't being forgotten, that balls aren't being dropped, so that we can be successful together as a team and can get our game done and get it out the door within the timeline that we're supposed to get it out the door.
The freaking glue, man. You're the freaking glue. Okay, I get it. So really, I just kind of want to I know this, obviously. I'm your brother. I get it. But hey, you know what? Listeners don't know you. So when did you decide you wanted to enter that realm, like create video games?
The poetic answer or the romantic answer it would be whenever I played The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, whenever I was younger. And you know, before then, yeah. I was thinking.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah. Very beloved. And before then, I'd always been into stories. I'd always been into storytelling and like creating worlds and just very interested in that and interested in fantasy worlds. And so I, you know, we're talking elementary school, junior high here. I thought about movie direction or writing or something along those lines. But it was Ocarina of Time that really flipped this switch in my head that like, wait a minute, no, video games are everything that movies are and more, because I get to be in that world. I get to interact there. I get to be a part of this experience, an active part of this experience, even a driver of this experience and not just a participant. So pretty much right there, I just decided this is what I want to do for a living. I want to make video games.
How old were you then?
Let's see. Gosh, that was probably, I don't know, 11, 12.
there's like I can count on one hand how many people I know that knew what they wanted to do at 11 and 12. But even then, like that year, you know, I mean, I don't even know the year. What year was that? Because you're talking about playing video games and wanting to create video games, which I can imagine in a time, knowing how old you are, when people didn't want to see that.
Right. So, you know, Legend of Zelda: Ocarina of Time came out on the Nintendo 64, released fall 1998. I got it a little bit late, not quite at its release. It was a birthday present, so I got it. Either would have been the following spring, 1999, or a year later, maybe 2000. I'm not exactly sure. So that's why I give the age range of 11 to 12.
Yeah. Damn,
But
dude.
somewhere right around there. And yes, I would consider myself one of the lucky ones that early on had in my head what I wanted to do. I still had to figure out what role I was going to play in the game industry. You know, I went to college and started off in a programming course, learning C and C++. I went to DigiPen Institute of Technology in Redmond, Washington. I transferred from their programming major to a design major to learn to be a game designer. But then I entered the industry as an associate producer and fell in love with production.
When life hands you
And yeah, and you know, never, I don't think I would have it any other way,
I'll be
other than being
honest.
a producer. This is what I like doing.
No, knowing you and like growing up with you, man, like I know you're doing exactly what I would have expected, to be honest. Like, 'cause you are the guy that literally will knit it together. You know, whatever it is. It seems like you've been that guy, right? That just will knit it together. The leader part, the leader role, and you keep everything organized. You've always been an organized person. You keep a calendar for every little tiny little thing. I would never do that. You know, it's just different personalities, but that definitely
Right.
fits you. I'm glad. What I'm glad about is that at least the game industry got that right as far as putting someone in the right role, because you can't say that a lot for other industries. You just can't. The one thing I would say now is, how has that changed? How has the industry changed since that first, you know, associate producer job?
Yeah, so it's actually really fascinating, because I've even just looking at like what my curriculum was like at DigiPen, the years that I was there versus what their curriculum looks like now because of how the landscape of the game industry has changed. So I entered into the industry, my first professional job was in 2010 after graduating from college.
Oh crap, that's 10 years. I've been telling
10
people,
years
dude,
ago.
8 years. This guy was in it 8 years, blah, blah, blah. Dang, dude. A
Yeah.
freaking
So
decade?
I've been doing video game
Decades?
production for 10 years
Decade.
now. been doing video game production for 10 years now. Entered in as an associate producer. I'm a senior producer now. I entered in doing. So one thing that's different is I entered in doing Flash games, you know, web-based stuff. Flash doesn't hardly exist anymore.
Freaking Google Chrome was trying to kick me off of that crap, dude. Like, hey, get off Flash. We're not accepting it anymore. Like, oh my gosh.
Right.
Wow.
It's hardly supported by browsers anymore.
Crazy.
So that's one thing that's different is platforms look entirely different. When you think back to 2010, so the first iPhone came out in 2007. The iPhone 3G, which I think is even more important, came out in 2008. Uh-oh. Okay.
Yeah,
I was
it
afraid
gets
that I
kind
was
of glitchy
losing
every
my
once in a
connection
while.
here. So the iPhone 3G came out in 2008, which I think is even more significant than the iPhone because that gave you the constant internet connection. And so there you start getting apps and you start getting an influx of new casual games or new bite-sized games for a di very different audience than the PlayStation 2, the Xbox, the Nintendo GameCube. The Xbox 360, the PlayStation 3 were offering. Also, Facebook launches in 2006. Facebook expands outside of colleges in 2007 or 2008. I don't remember exactly. And you get another influx of casual-based games, quick play games,
Was that Farmer's
for a
Game or something?
broader Farmville
Farmville.
from
Oh my
Zynga.
God.
Was the
Freaking
first
our aunts
really
and
big one.
uncles, bro. Our aunts and uncles were
Yes,
playing
yes.
that
So
freaking
you've got a whole
game.
new audience suddenly coming into games around 2008 through 2010 because of the iPhone and Facebook and and Wii Sports, because the Wii also launched in 2006. So you have this trifecta of the Wii, Facebook, and iPhones showing up while I'm in college, right? And so by the time I get out of college, the market is starting to change and starting to wrestle with this new place that it's in, because not only do you now have a very different audience, because it's no longer this very vertical slice of 14 to 36 year old males who are playing video games.
That's so true.
For primarily, and I'm not trying to stereotype and say that girls don't play video games, other people don't. I'm saying, like, the demographic, the primary demographic that is being marketed to.
That was it.
Is your 14 to 32, 35, 36 year old male.
Right.
Primarily. Obviously, there were some things on the outliers. The Nintendo DS had started expanding into other directions with Brain Age and Nintendogs and things like that. You can go and read and listen to all sorts of interviews from Reggie Fils-Aimé or Shuhei Yoshida or others about
I'll try to throw some links in the show notes of that crap. We'll see if I can remember it after this. So.
Sure, and I can help you out with any of that.
Awesome.
But anyway, also what you get is you suddenly have these free games that are available online, like Facebook. I don't have to pay anything for that, but I can. And so now you have this new market idea of, which really harkens back to the arcade days, of how do we get people to keep paying small amounts of money over a long period of time.
Dude, freaking old school microtransactions. That's what that is.
Yeah.
That's what arcade games were.
Yeah.
That's what arcade games were. They were designed as quarter munchers. They were
quarter munchers.
Balanced so that they would be difficult, so that you would feel like you're always making progress, but you're always losing and you always have to put more quarters in. And that's exactly what newer games started doing with Facebook and with iPhone stuff, because you either had a 99-cent game on iPhone or you had a free game that had these built-in transactions. The other thing that started happening around that same time, Unity released in 2009. And so Unity is, for those who don't know, it is a game development platform. It's an engine that was made available primarily for independent developers. So you have your big publishers or your large-scale developers like ArenaNet or a Bungie or a Microsoft or a Nintendo, where you're employing hundreds of people and you're connected to a publisher and marketing and all these other things, or you have your independent developers that really can be anywhere from, there are independent developers that are up to 100 people, but they're usually closer to, you know, 5 to 30 people working on a game together. So Unity was this new engine that was being made available. It wasn't the first of its kind, but it was a new one that was being made available for independent developers to jump into stuff. And its thing was, hey, you can download Unity for free.
Oh, dude, that's like almost like Blender. Blender's a freaking amazing piece of software, apparently. I haven't used it. I don't know how to use it. That's free.
Right.
It's insane.
So Unity's thing was, hey, you download our software for free. You start making a 3D game in it. And until you make, I don't remember what their original policy was, but for quite a while now, their policy has been, until you make over some threshold of money, like $100,000 or whatever, you can use this without a license. You can use this for free. You now can develop a game and you can release it.
If you can track that, which I'm sure they have a nice way of tracking.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing. You know what? Why don't they just do that to all, like DaVinci or like Logic Pro or any of these creator softwares, because people know creators do not have money. Right. This podcast makes $0, negative dollars, actually. I spend money for this crap. So, you know what I'm saying? Hey, I'll throw the Patreon in the show notes.
All right, go ahead.
Right. So Unreal, the other big player out there from other big game engine that's been around for, gosh, 20 or more years now, from Epic Games, those of you who know Fortnite, Fortnite's developed by Epic Games. It's running on Unreal Engine 4. Fortnite was one of the premier games in order to show off Unreal Engine 4 whenever it was being developed and being released a handful of years ago. So Unreal was the big competitor and was the thing. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but probably 70 to 80% of all of the games released for the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3 were built on Unreal Engine 3.
Holy.
But that one was like your Adobe or like your Logic Pro or any of your other stuff. You're paying for a license.
Right.
And it's per developer. It's per seat. You're paying a certain amount monthly in order to use this, in order to use all these tools, in order to have access to customer support, in order to have access to tutorials and assets and all of these types of things. Unity changed it and said, we're going to give you all that for free up front. Once you make money, then we're going to ask for licenses. Unreal has changed their setup 5 years ago, 6 years ago. Unreal Engine 4 is free to download now. You can start using Unreal for free until you make a certain amount of money.
Wow.
And then they're going to start asking you for licenses. Anyway, that was a lot of numbers and a little bit of history, but it lays a groundwork for how things have changed in the past 10 years, just since I've been working in the industry. Because it's more than just hardware changes of going from a PlayStation 3 to a PlayStation 4. The landscape of how games are monetized and how games are developed has changed. Something like Fortnite evolves out of something like Farmville. It evolves out of this idea, or even something like Unity. It evolves out of this idea of let's make our product available to the masses, everyone. Fortnite is available on nearly every platform. It might be available on every platform. You can download it for free, at least the Battle Royale version. You can download for free. You can start playing right away. You choose, as a consumer, how much money to put into the system. They are going to give you lots of incentives for putting money into the system.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
But you get to choose how you opt into that. The other thing that's changed in the past 10 years is subscriptions being moved over to consumers a lot more. With Apple Music,
dude, that's
with
what I'm talking about.
Spotify, what's that?
Subscripturation, that's what we call it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's also Netflix. Those things have been wildly successful. And so we've looked for ways of how those get emulated in the game industry. With PlayStation Plus or with Xbox Live or Xbox Live Ultimate or Xbox Game Pass, where you're paying a monthly fee and you have access to a library of games.
Yeah.
So, you know, Guild Wars was built off of this philosophy in a very similar way. When the first Guild Wars released in the US in 2004, I think it was 2004, maybe 2005.
What the heck, dude? You worked there.
I wasn't working there then when Guild Wars 1 released.
Yeah, true, true.
Guild Wars 2 released August 28th, 2012. I know that one.
Yeah, there we go.
That's the product that I work on. Our 8th anniversary is coming up next month, so log in and check it out.
Shout out, yeah.
But it was set up in a very similar way of disrupting the market because you had World of Warcraft and EverQuest 2 and Star Wars Galaxy, which were you pay for the box, you pay your $50 or $60 mm-hmm. for the box, you get your CD. You download, you install, you sign up for a monthly subscription, you pay your $15. So you pay the $60 in order to enter, and then you pay your $15 a month in order to continue to engage. Guild Wars said, you pay your $50, you're done. You pay $50, you enter, you now have full access. There is no monthly fee.
Yeah.
Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to give you access to ways to put more money into the system if you choose.
Right.
So you can buy new outfits. It's exactly what Fortnite does. You buy new outfits, you buy cosmetic things, you buy capes, anything like that.
I mean, it keeps you immersed.
Guild Wars 2 does the same thing.
Yeah, I don't – speaking on that, I am not sure – you know, coming from me perspective, I'm like, why the heck would I spend money on that? But if you're playing the game – Like, I got into Apex for a while. Same type of thing.
Yeah.
Play,
yeah.
Pay for microtransactions. You actually get pretty serious about that stuff. And I'm not going to lie. I did pay money for an outfit. That is as far as I'll go. And I did not go crazy. Still, my point is you get entranced. You're like, heck yeah, this is awesome. And I think that's the point. It's not a bad thing, I don't think.
Right.
You just said
it. And it's about identity, right?
Everybody spends money on their relaxation, so.
Yeah, it's a hobby, right? Yeah. What did you say, Kai?
Oh, it's an identity thing, right? Like, you spend money on clothes in the real world because you want to present yourself a certain way.
Yeah, it's a way to express yourself, for sure.
And then you spend money in a game in order to express yourself. And very much the same way. You're interacting with real people. Mm-hmm. In the case of an MMO, in the case of Apex or Destiny or Fortnite, you're interacting with real people.
Yeah.
People that you may be building relationships with, particularly in an MMO like Guild Wars 2, where we're very invested in our community and our players being a community for one another. And so you want to express yourself in different ways.
Yeah, that's true. All right, we'll take a quick break. After this, we'll get back into it.
What's up, Toasters? My name's Sky, and I'm the producer of this podcast. The truth is, we're not really that famous, and honestly, I think I like it that way. But we can't always get what we want, and I know in order to succeed at informing people on controversial topics such as this, it's going to take a lot of support from you guys, the real MVPs. So if you could do your broskies over here at Toasty Creations a favor and subscribe to any of the content we create that you enjoy, that'd be the best thing that's happened to me all day. Probably. In fact, if you get 10 people to subscribe to my content, let us know, because you might even get some sweet Toasty swag. If you don't like it though, please don't do it. As a guy on a mission trying to make the world a better and more informed place, I want to earn that like and that subscribe. Oh, one last thing, people. Don't be shy. We want your feedback, so email me or tweet me with the links provided in the show notes. Okay, now back to the show.
So another thing I will say that's interesting to me is how society has changed. And you've obviously already explained it. We already went through like the whole breakdown of what happened, right? Which is awesome. I loved it. We just kind of skipped over the part where you didn't skip over. I'm saying society where we would, cause I know how high school was for you and where we would just like, it wasn't cool to be in the games and these guys were nerds or they're geeks.
A lot
more
mainstream now for sure.
Yeah. And and I won't say that there's a lot more to society as far as why that's changed, but games in general are way more accepted, way more. And it's a really good thing, but where the heck did mom and, you know, Aunt Dana start getting onto games all of a sudden? Like
arcades.
How did they, where's the marketing strategy? Really?
It's in the accessibility, right? And it's in the image. So if games are Call of Duty, then a large amount of the American population doesn't care.
Sure. And it's like you said, the 15 to 32 year old males.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. If games are Farmville, so let me actually back up. Everyone has always liked games. Everyone maybe hasn't known or admitted that they liked video games, but everyone likes play. As humans, we like play.
Monopoly.
And we like play either to interact with one another as a social experience, or we like play to overcome a challenge, to feel a sense of mastery, of skill. Or we like play in observing others. Sports have always been popular. Since before the Greeks, sports have always been popular. They've always been a spectacle. Whether you're participating as an athlete who is competing or you're participating as a member of the audience who's cheering on and observing and learning how it works, or a commentator who's learning how it works and breaking things down and doing analysis. That stuff has always been around as long as we've had human civilization. And so video games have just, in some ways, video games have had to grow up and expand and broaden. And that's where things like the Wii and Facebook and the iPhone came in. And I'm not saying that it was only those three things, but I'm using those three as examples.
Sure, yeah.
Or even the Nintendo DS with, I mentioned Brain Age and Nintendogs, where, oh, suddenly I've got a game that is about teaching me, you know, allowing me to play with dogs and care for them, something that I'm interested in, or allowing me to, you know, train my prefrontal cortex and my memory and stuff. And this is not the same as me running around shooting a bunch of guys, shooting and looting as you do in Call of Duty or yeah. Borderlands or Fortnite or PUBG or anything like that.
Shooting people in
your mind. It's wrapped up differently, even though a lot of those same core tenets are there. And another thing that has changed over the past 10, 20 years is people have grown up. You know, the kids who were the people who were kids when the NES came out in the 80s are now adults who are now business owners or floor managers or, you know, some of them getting into the age of being politicians. Like, yeah. You grow up.
Yeah.
People from the 70s and 80s have grown up. People from the 90s, like myself, have grown up.
Yeah.
Or like you have grown up. And we grew up around all of this technology and just accepting it easily because we were the core demographic then. Mm-hmm. And so as we've grown up, we're more accepting. But also as we've grown up, we've realized that we still want to make games for us. You started this thing off saying like the 5-year-old across the street can beat you at any game.
Sure, yeah.
And in a lot of ways, that sentiment can be true. Like a 40-year-old and a 20-year-old aren't going to be able to compete on the same level
right.
in Counter-Strike or League of Legends, just as a 40-year-old and a 20-year-old aren't going to be able to compete in the same way in soccer or football.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Yeah.
And so the 40-year-old still wants to play games.
Yeah.
Same way that he did before. Even though he can't play them the same way, like he might still play the same games and he might still compete. And I'm not saying that every 40-year-old is worse than every 20-year-old or anything. I'm making some generalizations.
Everyone here. Needs to play games or can play games, right?
Like, but yeah,
your
demographic grows up and your demographic expands as it grows up. And so some of it is just a natural outpouring of that. And then also the breakdown in the barriers of how games are distributed and how games are paid for and marketed that I was explaining, that's also happened. The internet makes it a whole lot easier because now I can just click a button and start playing a game. I don't have to go to a very special store like Best Buy or GameStop and look at a whole bunch of box art and plop down $60 or $50 on something that I don't know what this is.
Yeah.
There's a guy with a sword and a girl with a bikini on the cover. What? Am I going to like this? What's going on?
Yeah.
Right?
Or RuneScape, dude. Remember that? Huh?
Yeah. And you look at it, and then it's also awesome. To that point, graphical fidelity has gotten better. So that you have so many more art styles that are available to us.
Yeah.
And we've grown beyond just chasing photorealism that now – we have the technology. You can, if you could dream it, you can make a game out of it. Anything that you can imagine, you can make a game out of. We can do papercraft games. We can do claymation games. We can do photorealistic games. We can do cel shaded games. We can do games that look like a Pixar movie. Like whatever you come up with,
so
we can make it.
The more it grows, the more the gaming industry grows, the more it is for everyone.
Right, mm-hmm. And so you can appeal to everyone.
Yeah. Well, I'll move it into essentially I want to kind of talk about what – more about your studio really. What makes
sure.
I don't know. In that – so I read the interviews and the publication by PC Gamer, right? It was about PC Gamer?
Yes.
Okay.
Most recently about working from home.
Did it mention the size or whatever? What – essentially I'm just trying to get down to this. What makes a AAA – studio. Everyone's always throwing that out there. AAA, AAA, AAA.
Sure.
What's a double A? What's an A? What's a B? You know?
Well, have you ever heard the term of a B movie?
Yeah, I actually have heard that term.
Okay. So Matt's nodding. So what's a B movie?
There you go.
It's just a low budget film, essentially. One that doesn't quite do as well in theaters as expected, perhaps a flop.
Right.
Typically right. Low budget,
but might still be a cult hit or something along those lines.
Oh,
so
yeah.
AAA refers to its budget.
Okay, I got you. Okay,
primarily, your
so
AAA
no matter
games
how
studios,
big you are, no matter how big you are, you could be a AAA studio. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's where personally I find some of the monikers that get tossed around, particularly around like independent game development or indies, being a little misleading. They were maybe more helpful 6 to 12 years ago than they are now. Because being an independent developer simply means that you're, and in my opinion, that you're self-publishing, which I don't even know if that's necessarily accurate anymore, because there are a lot of independent developers. There are a lot of independent publishers who work with independent developers in order to publish their stuff. But you're not owned by anyone. You're not tied into a very specific contract where like, oh, we are owned by Sony, and so we're always making stuff for Sony or anything like that, or we're a large international publisher like Ubisoft, or we're making games for all different platforms, but we've got a $1 billion budget or something. CD Projekt Red, the creators of The Witcher 3, upcoming Cyberpunk 2077, they're an independent developer. They make all of their, they are their own studio.
Wow.
They don't work with other publishers. They publish their own stuff. They make AAA games.
I was about to
say, Witcher 3 is a AAA game.
The Witcher 3 is
right.
So well known.
Yeah, my fiance
right.
plays that game.
Yeah.
She's playing it right now, I bet you.
That's awesome.
So that's a AAA game. So it's really just a qualification of budget, you know, in the same way that you would talk about a blockbuster film,
yeah.
which I guess a blockbuster film is trying to say that it makes a certain amount of money in the box office, but it also suggests a certain budget that's being put into it, either both behind the production of it, mm-hmm. of building it, and the marketing of it, of how we're presenting it to consumers,
right?
And how many people we're trying to get in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all about just how much money goes into things.
Gotcha. So you're talking a lot about publishers and developers, and what you're saying, I guess, is it similar to like a book? Like you.
Yep.
It is. Okay. Now, one thing I'll ask though is when you write a book, don't you go and seek out the publisher?
Unless you already have a deal.
Okay.
You know, there are going to be authors who have a very specific deal. Like J.K. Rowling didn't seek out a new publisher with every Harry Potter book.
Sure. I get it. So but what I'm going for is, so you, who's your publisher? As ArenaNet, who's the publisher?
ArenaNet publishes their own stuff. Or well, that's not entirely true. We work with NCSoft, our parent company, and publish in conjunction with them.
Interesting. So the next question is, does that I guess I hear a lot about crunch times and the pressure, and you know, we have to get games out this quickly, but the expectations are skewed or not correct in what it takes.
Right.
How often do you face that? Not necessarily
personally,
in your company, maybe
sure.
in your industry as a whole. You know a lot of people in the industry. I know you do. I
right.
just mean, like,
so,
I'm not trying to get you to say anything wrong here. You know what I mean? Like, that's not it.
Of course. So me personally, not often.
Right.
ArenaNet is very good about being anti-crunch, about respecting people's time and wanting people to have lives outside of work. We want them to love their work. We want them to love working at ArenaNet. We want them to put in a fantastic 40 hours and then go home.
Do you have job openings right now? Or?
Do your own thing. We do. You can check out arenan.net/careers.
That's what I'm talking about. Plug it right now, dude. Okay? Show notes. Yeah,
and
it sounds awesome.
Look for openings. So that's something that's been really important, because the industry has had a history of problems with crunch. And for those who don't know, crunch refers to these prolonged seasons of working overtime. of working 60, 70, 80 hour weeks in order to get games out the door. Games are not easy to make.
Imagine that.
Former employee of Microsoft once made a comment on a different podcast that I've listened to that games are things that hate to be made, which I think is brilliant because it feels like that a lot. Games are not hard, are not easy to make. They are very difficult to make. Ask any independent developer who has had a successful or semi-successful game that has gone to market, and they will tell you how grueling and how difficult it is. And how many new obstacles you run into that you don't expect. You can also look at the fact of how many Kickstarter campaigns for games are successful. How many of them ship on the time that they say that they're going to ship on, how many of them ship on the budget that they say that they were going to ship on, and then how many of them are successful whenever they actually release.
These days, I feel like I see a lot of headlines. Like, I don't play games a lot. I have played games. I usually find a game that I really like, and I'm just like, oh, I'm all over it for a while. But I see these headlines constantly, like, this game got, you know, delayed, or that game got delayed. Like, almost every big game that we hear about and everyone's ready for.
So like a three or 6 month delay, something like that.
Seems like a delay, which is fine by me, because I have someone that tells me about it. And
you have to come out
freaking sucks. Yeah, you got to put your time in.
Right.
So I get it. For publisher side of it, it's kind of like where I would be like, are they pushy? Yeah.
So it's easy, I think, to riff on the publisher the same way that it's easy to for a teenager to complain about their parents.
So it's almost like the cop-out, you know, or whatever. I don't know if you'd call it that.
Well, and I don't want to say that either. I want to show a lot of respect to publishers for the role that they play. The vast majority of games that get released and that you play, and the vast majority of games that you got for Christmas because they came out in November, that's all thanks to the publisher. Like, those things don't happen on their own. Those things don't happen without the publisher. The publisher makes sure that things get to market, and the publisher makes sure that you know that the game is coming and that the game is making it to market.
I mean, it's
and that the game works correctly on whatever platform you're going to play it on, because, you know, Sony or Microsoft or Nintendo, they don't let just anyone start developing a game and then release it on their system. You have to pay a lot of fees in order to get their development kits. You have to go through a long process of getting certified by them. You have to go through lots of testing. You have to go through this big process in order to get your thing either printed onto discs that'll work in their system or on their store so that it can be downloaded. Same goes for Steam or Epic or anything like that. The barrier to entry is different depending on what platform you want to go after, but there's still work that needs to be done there. Publishers tend to be the ones in the relationship who handle that.
Wow. I mean, it sounds a lot like a bigger form of what you do at your job. You know what I mean? Like, they are the ones that...
A little bit. So
kinda
I
like
do
herd the cattle and get the game out, and you herd the sheep and get the game out, you know?
Yeah. Very kind of similar. You know, and so publishers, they have the pressure of also watching the budget because they're the ones who are paying for all of this, and they're paying for the marketing dollars and for, you know, negotiating all the deals with Sony or Nintendo or Microsoft in order to make sure that the thing gets released and stuff like that in order to, and they're the ones who are looking and saying, okay, we really want to make sure that this thing gets out before Christmas, or we really want to make sure that this thing is available at launch with the new system because that's what consumers are looking for. And so that's where tension can come in, right? Like, anytime you bring up money into a conversation, there can be tension.
Yeah, it's true. You money and deadlines. Money and deadlines.
Right, and deadlines. And,
yeah,
you know, that's part of the relationship between a developer and a publisher is money and deadlines.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of the conversation is going to be most of the time when you're at brass tacks is money and deadlines. There's all sorts of stuff that you can watch out there about those relationships. And so developers, you know, they want to make the best thing. Publishers, they want to make the most successful. They want the thing to be successful. And sometimes definitions of those don't see eye to eye. sometimes things go sideways because, again, making video games is hard. Knowing exactly what's going to be successful, what's going to work is hard, especially if you're trying new things. Game developers are always wanting to try new things.
Mm-hmm.
We're always wanting to be creative. We're always wanting to push the boundaries. Yep. And sometimes you push the boundaries and the boundaries push back.
Yeah, like that doesn't work. Oh, crap. Abort.
Yeah, and then you've got to figure things out of what are you going to do. And there are so many wonderful stories out there of video games that, you know, just came together by the skin of their teeth. And that's how it feels most of the time when making a game, is that the thing isn't working until all of it's working, and, which sounds a little tautological, but like...
Well, it's almost like being behind is good, you know, in some jobs, maybe that one too, you know?
Well, I don't know. It's almost like you think of baking something, and I'm going to apologize right now. I love food analogies. You think of baking something, and you put all the ingredients together for your cake, and you've got theories. There's a lot of theory that goes into what flavors work together, what ingredients are going to work together, how's this going to come out right. But you really never know until it's gone in the oven and it comes out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you put it in the oven and it comes out.
It has to go through it, yeah.
And dinner is in an hour. And wait a minute, this didn't work.
Right.
And now you got to figure something, you know.
Right, yeah.
We got to find a different icing. We got to find, or this piece wasn't ready, or whatever it is. So you're having to work through those problems. And so it's a little bit like that of you. It's not until all the ingredients are together until you really know that, like, yep, this is the thing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of faith that goes into it up until that point of like, okay, I know from experience, I know from these philosophies, I know from this psychology, I know from this piece that, like, this is going to work. I know that this ingredient is good. The jumping works really well. The shooting works really well. Surely when we put them together, they're going to work great. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they don't.
Or like the mounting in Guild Wars 2. I know it's a big deal now. So,
yeah.
One of my best friends, his wife plays Guild Wars 2 a lot. I'm talking about Haley, if you didn't know. She talked about the mounting. She's like, the mounting, that's amazing. I just started playing Guild Wars 2 after a long stint of, a long lapse and not playing. I got back on it. It's awesome. It's great. Whole thing's changed. I'm like, that's my brother, you know? But I, you know, whatever. But so what's it, you're talking about that time where you're like putting it in the oven. You're like, okay, well, holy crap, let's see what happens. What does that look like at the office, at your studio? Are you guys scrambling around, or you know what I mean? When you guys are in the studio,
I would imagine like a gamer's development studio is like the movie Grandma's Boy. That's what I think of.
I'm sorry, I actually don't even chairs. Know.
Have you never seen like cubicles?
Was that a B-rated film?
You've never seen Grandma's Boy?
No.
Oh man.
I haven't either, but I can tell you most depictions of what game development looks like are entirely wrong.
That's all right.
Actually, yeah. If you really want to know what it looks like behind the curtain, there are two different resources out there for you. One, there's a group on YouTube called NoClip, and they do documentaries on video games that have been released and what their development looked like. Check them out. They have some good stuff.
I don't know. That sounds pretty awesome. I kind of want to do that.
There's some really great things out there. There is also when Double Fine put together their Kickstarter game, Double Fine Adventure, which turned into, I'm forgetting the name. But their new adventure game that they did on Kickstarter, as part of that, they actually filmed the entire development process and released it as a documentary.
That's awesome.
I think called the Double Fine Adventure documentary or something like that.
Yeah, you get
you can find it low quality on YouTube, or you can buy it high quality HD.
Ooh, that's the way to do it.
Right.
Buy the high quality version
and check it out. But they're really good peeks behind the curtain into what this looks like. So some of them are cubicles and stuff. What's that?
You guys do that at ArenaNet? Do you guys ever have a film crew come in or somebody filming some stuff, you know?
We don't. What we do is we do guild chats every other Friday. We have a guild chat where we have members of the development team come and talk about something. Particularly whenever we release new episodes. So yeah. Guild Wars 2 does episodic content as part of Guild Wars 2 Living World, where we release a new episode every 2 to 3 months. Our most recent one was the third episode in our Icebrood saga, released in May.
So you have seasons then as well?
It's yes, we have seasons.
Two. Okay.
Right. Seasons and sagas in order to kind of group the episodes together. It's very much like a TV series.
Right.
Where we continue the story, we add in a new map, we give players access to new content. And if you log in whenever it releases, you get it for free. And you get to keep it forever.
That's pretty cool.
It's an awesome perk.
Again, very much like a TV series that if you're there whenever it's airing, you get to watch it.
Yeah.
So after we release those, whenever we do big updates, we'll usually have some members of that development team who worked on whatever that update was on our guild chat, on our YouTube channel, to talk about some of what the experience of putting that update together was.
So,
like.
So your YouTube channel, that's guild chat, or what is the YouTube channel called?
If you look for Guild Wars 2 on YouTube, okay, cool. Then you'll find it, and there's a guild chat playlist or channel within there where you can find all of our past episodes. There's a lot because we've been doing this pretty regularly for the past 6 to 8 years.
I mean, it's worth it. You're getting there's marketing to it. There's includence in it as far as like giving people a chance to be a part of it. I had never been to a game studio, of course, until I went to your one of your release.
You got to go to the Pathfire launch party.
Pathfire launch party, which is, I guess it was a big deal. And holy crap, everyone was so, you know, excited and into it. And they were just like, this is amazing. Oh my gosh, my life's work almost. And now I think I get a better view or a better perspective of it. As far as, obviously, a lot of work had to go into this to make them this excited about this thing. Right?
Yep.
And you guys didn't even care. Like, I was thinking in the back of my mind, right? Because I don't know Guild Wars 2 that well. I don't really play games that much. I'm thinking, well, me being the other side of it, are there a lot of people that's going to be watching? Are there a lot of people that's going to be playing this game? What's going on here? The thing is you guys didn't seem to care about that regardless. That wasn't something that was on y'all's minds. Yeah, and I didn't ask everyone, obviously. I'm not picking y'all's brains. I'm not a psychic. It just seemed like the inspiration you guys had in each other, everything else, threw that all away. It was like, well, who cares almost? And that's awesome because that shows me that you guys can be separate from that money deadline.
It's more about accomplishing the mission.
Yeah, it's more about accomplishing the mission. And that's awesome. Obviously, I've never been to other game studios, so I don't know what it's like over there.
I would imagine that it's very similar. We care. Amazing. Game developers care a lot about our craft.
Yeah.
And, you know, the opportunity to make something and then share it with someone else. And you've been putting a lot of time into making this and you're excited about it. And with Path of Fire, we were introducing mounts to Guild Wars 2. We knew how good they were. We knew how exciting they were because we'd been playing with them.
Yeah.
We'd been iterating them and tweaking them and making them better. And we were excited now, first to get to say, oh, we're done, we did it, we accomplished the mission, like Matt said, but also now other people get to see. And not long after that launch party, people were back at their desks logging into the game so that they could play alongside players who were getting to experience this all for the first time.
That's awesome. That's really
to
cool
be right there with them to experience those moments, knowing what was going to come. When we release new episodes and new content for the game, we love watching people on Twitch and on YouTube playing that content and knowing, anticipating where they're going to get excited, what their reactions are going to be with things. And it's fun.
It's like being the guy with a chainsaw at a haunted house. Like, you get to enjoy watching the people.
I don't know. Yeah, that's
everything.
Wow, that's a
maybe.
It's a hot take.
I never thought of myself as a guy with a chainsaw in a haunted house.
But the other thing that I would say, really ask is like, so you have all this camaraderie here. How does it work? Like, do you guys ever do anything with other game development teams? Does that happen? Is there a lot of
collaborations,
or is it so like such? If you have one game, you're kind of secretive about that game. Obviously, I get it. Mm-hmm. How does that work? You know, do you guys do that?
The game development industry is fairly small and fairly tight knit. We know a lot of people who work at other game development studios. We know a lot of people inside the industry, currently inside the industry, and who used to be inside the industry. We mingle with one another. We go to conventions together and see one another, or find out, oh, you're going to be at this convention too. We haven't seen each other in a while. Let's meet up. Let's get some drinks. Let's do dinner. Around here in the Seattle, Washington area, there are groups for different sports leagues, like a game developer soccer league that's company versus company.
That's cool.
And not every development studio in the area is going to necessarily participate, but they have that option. I think there's also flag football. There are things like that, ways to help intermingle and stuff. So, you know, there is some competition in the sense of your product. There's this product and then there's our product, and there are only so many consumers out there and so many consumer dollars out there.
Yeah,
but hardly that's thought about or talked about. And we're just as excited about Ghost of Tsushima coming out in 2 weeks for the PlayStation 4 as anyone else might be. That's a new game coming from Sucker Punch Productions, exclusively for the PlayStation 4 later this month. We'll be just as excited about a Destiny update as anyone else.
Right.
We're tuning in to the Google Stadia live stream event to find out what's going on, just like anyone else might be, because we got into this because we love video games.
Right.
And we're excited about video games. I'm wearing a Mario shirt right now because I love video games and I'm excited about video games.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's really cool.
We, in our office, have a room set up with a library of games so that we can play with one another. And also so that we can be aware of what's out there and we can get more ideas and borrow and share with one another. And, you know, I might talk to someone from at Bungie about, hey, how have you guys worked through this problem? How do you guys do this? And obviously, we're not going to talk about, like, here's the game I'm working on and here's what we're doing.
Right. Yeah. I get it.
But we're going to be talking about, like, hey, I'm having, you know, this thing with my team, or we're working through this AI problem.
Right.
And you're going to talk shop together.
That's awesome, actually. And I think that doesn't, it should happen. It doesn't happen in other industries. I'd say the closest thing I can think of, and I haven't even been in it, is the tech industry. Except for the fact that may no longer be true, because there's more competition there, you know. I think that with the way you guys are in the game industry and the way you guys treat it, it's almost like a, you know, nothing can really go wrong because you're all in it together. Does that make sense? And when I say go wrong, I don't mean in one game. I don't mean in one. I mean with the industry as a whole. But with one caveat, I mean, the last question I have, literally the last thing I kind of want to, we can kind of lead off with this or whatever, but is you mentioned how games have come up and now they're free to play almost with microtransactions, or maybe they're just free to play. I don't know. Has that hurt anything? Or do you think it's just a part of progression? And it needs to happen.
It's primarily a part of progression. There's a lot of opportunity that affords, because you can reach a broader audience. You can get games accessible to more people. Options are always good, right? giving people the option rather than just saying, no, you can only play this type of game this type of way. Being able to say, hey, you can play any of these games, all of these different ways. Choose your flavor, choose your color.
Yeah.
Right?
It's not for
so options are always good in that regard. You know, I think there are some risks that go along with it of that are not special or particular to the game industry of the perceived value of something could be diminished. If you're same argument that comes up with food, right? Of like fast food versus sitting down at a restaurant versus cooking your own food.
Yeah.
And the perceived quality around those things. That may or may not be true, and I'm not going to make any sort of statements about an industry that I don't work in and that I don't know about. but there can be a perceived value there with some consumers where, well, what makes your cheeseburger better than their cheeseburger, where I can get that one for $3 and yours is $20. Like, why would I pay $20 for a cheeseburger? But the ingredients that are going into this $20 cheeseburger are a lot more,
yeah.
Or maybe there's a brand name association with it, or maybe right. There's something about the restaurant experience of, yeah, well, we're giving you real linen napkins and we've got live music and, you know, you're paying for that whole experience. It's more than just the cheeseburger. And so you see the same thing in games, right? Of there can be a perception of, well, I can download and play this thing for free. Why should I pay for this other stuff?
Right. I don't know if you're necessarily going to get away from that. I'm not sure, but in my industry, like the same thing happens, you know, why would I pay more at a BMW dealership? Well,
right.
Because you're getting this and this and blah, 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 you know, free valet service, whatever it might be. There are a lot of customers that still will not, I don't know if they will ever not necessarily understand it. Cause I think they understand it, but I don't know if they'll ever just like it, you know? Yeah, maybe you're just going to lose those right. customers. I can see that though, because like, you know, I played Apex, but I ended up buying something, see? And I don't know if that's kind of flips it. I don't know if that kind of like changes it, because if it was just free to play, I might end up being the guy that's like, I'm just going to play stuff for free. Why wouldn't I? You know? But like Little Caesar's Pizza is $5. Why don't I just get right. that pizza? Well, it's made out of cardboard, dude. Like, what are you thinking, you know?
Or another example, I can go on the internet and I can read the news. Why do I need to subscribe to a newspaper?
Because mm-hmm. WSJ actually has a lot of good news. Anyway, sorry. That was a
true, though.
Subjective
well, so,
view.
but right there, there's the example, right? Well, there's a quality, there's an aspect to this, and people need to get paid, right? for what they do, man. Particularly if they're doing it as a living.
Right.
And like nothing's free. The first rule you learn in an economics class is 10 stoffel. There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Right.
Nothing's
happen.
Free.
Nope.
Those ads that are on the blogs that you're checking out, that's in order to help pay for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing anywhere that you go.
Yeah. And I will say, like, that's something else that's changed. It's kind of a tangent anyway, but who cares? Ads, like, I run this website now, and I'm trying to do podcasts, and, like, you know, why do you think we have a break in the middle? Well, it's for a freaking ad, but I got to do it. You know, you got to pay whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get that, and I think I'm seeing a lot of the other side of it, too. So I guess maybe is that kind of what it takes? You know, maybe it takes
right.
walking in someone else's shoes for yeah. a little while, you know?
Got to play the game.
So those documentaries you mentioned are probably good for that. Let's show people.
Yeah, I'm all for actually done. Exposing
how hard they work and what you're yeah. paying for.
Yeah.
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 And that's the reason I wanted to have you on the show right now. Yeah. I mean, I think that you being in it 10 years have a really solid view of it, because you started making Daniel Tiger's Night Day,
yep.
whatever app, right? It was a kid's
type. My first success.
First success, man. And now you're making a quote-unquote AAA game, right? It is AAA, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Triple A MMORPG.
It's like the journey of Kai Harris, but like in a developer's world, that means something. Cause I still to this day don't think there's a lot of it. I don't think there's a lot of people that know it.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of misperceptions out there.
Right.
It takes, just on the economic side, and something that I like to try and mention to people, it takes, particularly for a large game like Guild Wars 2, or even like Fortnite, though it's free, or Halo, or The Legend of Zelda, hundreds of people in order to put these games together. Hundreds of people working for years in order to put these games together. Fortnite was in development for 7 years. From the time that it was announced and when it was released, which means it could have been in development for longer. I don't know the inner workings at Epic behind that.
They still have to get paid, right? Like,
right. So you're working for 7 years, footing a bill for a game that hasn't come out yet. And these games cost hundreds of millions of dollars, upwards to hundreds of millions of dollars, tens to hundreds of millions of dollars. And then Fortnite, Fortnite Battle Royale, at least, you can download and play without spending a penny.
Yeah.
But the game itself costs.
But the game itself to develop costs, we'll say, $100 million.
Yeah. I should know. I don't know.
And,
sure, at least,
you know, if you go the more traditional route of The Legend of Zelda, and you've got, I don't know, we'll say $50 million for The Legend of Zelda. I'm kind of making up numbers here for the sake of an example.
Yeah, you're good.
But even if that's something like $10 million, you sell that game for $60 a box. How many boxes does it take at $60 each to reach $10 million?
How many licks does it take to get to the center of Tootsie Pop, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like,
oh, but wait. The box itself costs money. I forgot about that.
You need to make it. The company has to make the box.
Right. And shipping to stores has cost money. And the stores, they want to make money off of it also, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're the ones selling it. And this is talking purely the traditional route and not counting digital stuff, but there are very similar costs associated with even going the digital route. So you add all that up, and games are expensive. It takes a lot.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of work. It takes that 3 to 7 years of work in order to put this thing together to release out there, and then to watch and see, is all of that work, is all of that effort going to be worth it? Are we going to get enough paychecks or enough money so that we can keep getting paychecks for the next 3 years so that we can make a sequel, or we can the next 7 years so that we can make another game? And again, these are some generalities for the sake of an example. Not every game takes 7 years to make. Most games don't take 7 years to make.
Right. Cool. That's why. That's
Red Dead Redemption 2 probably took 10 years to make. But
yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, it's like a contract position all the time. That's the only way I can describe it. You know, because I know that it's been publicized already, so I can say this. Arena has gone through some layoffs and things like that.
Sure.
Because it's not easy. You know, you guys might have open
right
now, but you know, what if the next season doesn't go as well or whatever? You know, because money matters. But what I meant earlier too is that it's amazing how even with all that on your shoulders, you still have the common goal and want to create that game. You know what I mean?
Right.
Is there anything else you kind of want to touch on?
Check out Guild Wars 2.
Check out Guild Wars 2.
You can play for free. Go to GuildWars2.com. You can download. You can play for free. Our entire core game, up to our max level of 80, is available for free.
Is it on all platforms?
Playthrough. It's available on PC and Mac.
Okay.
PC and Mac. It's a PC game, so that's an MMO, right? So
yeah, primarily a PC game.
The two, literally, you have two games in that realm, and you've got World of Warcraft and Guild Wars 2. And quite honest with you, I played Guild Wars 2. It is It's up there. I don't know. I've never played World of Warcraft, so I can't really.
It's better.
Not trying to make competition, but it's obviously better. My brother freaking makes the game, dude. So, yeah, obviously. All right, this has been the toastiest episode we have ever had, I promise. Easily. And I can't wait to show you guys more. That was Kai Harris, my brother, a lead producer at ArenaNet, giving you the spill of the game industry. All right, guys. So stay toasty.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.